everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show planned for all of you today. My guest will be Brett Tolley, who is the community organizer for the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, and I'll tell you more about him in a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in around the news and share some exciting info with all of you. First, I want to just let you all know that Progressive Radio Network now has an app. It's really great. You can actually take the station with you wherever you go. So we wanted to encourage all of our listeners to go to your cell phone store and search the Progressive Radio Network, and you'll find the app. And it would just be great to, that way you can listen live to the shows wherever you are when you're in the car. You can also listen to past shows through the archives. So go to the App Store and check it out. Lots of great things going on in and around the city that I want to share with you. Starting tomorrow, there is the Real Truth About Health Conference, which is an amazing event. It's a free 10-day conference taking place at the Hilton Hotel in Melville. That's out on Long Island. It's only about 40 minutes from the city, maybe 45 minutes from the city, but it's well worth the schlep, because they have over 35 of some of the world's top authors and food activists there talking. You can go online to the Real Truth About Health Conference and get a schedule. The conference is free. There's, you know, good vegan food afterwards being shared for everybody. But the main thing is that there's some real movers and shakers that will be speaking about books that they have written, and it is just going to be a great conference. So I hope to see some of you there. Also this weekend, the Long Island Seed Consortium is having their annual seed swap. That takes place at Suffolk Community College in Riverhead, and that's from like 9 to 3. And they have speakers and, you know, bring some seeds that you might want to share or swap. But it's a fun time, and it's a great opportunity to meet some other farmers and people who care about biodiversity in our food. So you'll get some seeds to some rare varieties, and it should be a lot of fun. February 6th. Pace University is sponsoring the Natural Resource Defense Council is having their Food Law Initiative annual event. And attorney and farmer Jennifer Grossman will interview human rights experts and advocate Smita Narula about the right to food. And it should be really great. There's a reception that follows, and that's on Tuesday, February 6th from 6 to 9. You do need to register online, so go to my website and you can find the link. February 10th, the North Shore Land Alliance, which is a wonderful land trust organization out here on Long Island that's saving a lot of open space land from developers, they're sponsoring a nature journaling program, which is a family-friendly activity on Saturday at 2 p.m., that's February 10th, out in Cold Spring Harbor. So that's a fun event. Check that out. February 14th, the Organic Seed Alliance is having their annual conference. That's taking place in Oregon, so I don't know where people are located, but if seed and if you're a farmer and having good seeds is really important to you, you might want to schlep out to that conference. I shouldn't say schlep. It would be a pleasure to go to that conference in Oregon. So it's the Organic Seed Growers Conference, and it's the largest organic seed event in the U.S. And you'll hear about cutting-edge research and policy advocacy and trade knowledge and techniques and lots of really great discussions. So there will be presenters, panel discussions, and lots of opportunity for networking. So check that out. February 15th, Food and Water Watch, which if you guys don't know about Food and Water Watch, incredible nonprofit organization that really works hard to make policy change and to get people interested and active in petitioning our representatives to keep our air and water clean. Anyway, they're sponsoring a fossil fuel documentary called To the Ends of the Earth. And it's a powerful documentary about the dangers of drilling for fossil fuels. And there will be a potluck before the film, so you can bring a dish to share. And that's going to be taking place at the Church in the Gardens in Forest Hills. So you can go to Food and Water Watch website or my website to get more information about that. On February 20th, at Project Farmhouse, there's going to be a great event and learn what's good this winter season. So anyway, again, it's called Fresh in February, and that's at the Project Farmhouse. So it's going to be like an open market for some fresh produce. So you can check that out on my website as well. And on February 23rd, there's another documentary screening called Taking Root, The Vision of Wangari Maathai. And that's a 80-minute film followed by a brief discussion taking place at the Rutgers Presbyterian Church in New York City. And admission for that is free. And so check that out. There's lots more on my website. I don't want to take the time to go over it all right now, but you should check that out. So I'm sure many of you listened to the president's speech the other night. It was a bit depressing. Just because you know what's coming out of his mouth is not the truth of what he really feels. And it's just, you know, it just continues to be disturbing. Yeah, I don't really know where to go with that, except that he's just, you know, making everything go backwards. You know, he talks about clean coal. Well, we all know there's no such thing as clean coal. We are now exporting oil and becoming one of the largest exporters of oil in the world. And why? How are we doing that? We're doing that because of fracking. We are extracting enough oil and natural gas from the earth, all for the benefit of the profit of oil and gas companies. And how does that benefit us? It doesn't. It actually pollutes our air and our water. And one of the very disturbing things that we've all been reading about is how the wastewater from this fracking is now being sold to farmers in California for them to spray on their crops. So now even actually, I'm not sure if they're using it on organic or not. I'd have to look into that, but I think I heard that they were. But whether it's organic or not, I know the pistachios coming out of California, the pomegranate juice from pomegranate juice is using it. It's just a horrible practice. I mean, think about all the toxins that are in this wastewater that we've read about, you know, the water going on fire, you know, people getting sick from drinking the water actually being non-consumable, just really horrible things. And they are now selling this water to farmers. So we really want to stop that. But you also, I just, you know, really question the whole idea of extracting more oil so that they can, you know, transport it through pipelines that leak, that, you know, destroy the soil and the earth. And then export it and, you know, have these big foundries out in the middle of the water, you know, that explode and pollute the water. And I mean, it's just bad all the way around, and all for the profit of oil companies. Why don't we create incentives for these companies to transition to renewable energy? I just don't understand what we're waiting for. And of course, with our current president, we're going to have to keep waiting for a long time. Another wonderful thing he's doing is the president is working with his administration to loosen the standards that the Obama administration worked so hard to get for school lunch. We're really trying to make the school lunch program in the U.S. healthier. The school lunch program has been really horrible food quality that they give to our children. And for many children, many, many children, this hot meal, their lunch, is the only meal that they get of the day. They get home to an empty refrigerator. So it's really important that the food that we give them in school is nutritious and is supporting to their whole system so that they can learn. And they are trying to turn back the clock and, you know, instead of reducing the salt and adding fruits and vegetables and whole grains, no trans fat, getting rid of soda and junk food, instead they're trying to reverse all that and allow private companies to sell the junk food again, fast food companies that sell them the French fries and the pizza to be able to continue as usual. And we just want to petition that and try to make them uphold the program that the Obama administration put in place. So please sign the petition on my website. The Center for Science and the Public Interest has a great petition going around, and I'd really love all of you to sign it. You know, in this day and age, the only silver lining coming out of this Trump administration is that we are getting more and more people to become activists. And I talk about that all the time, and it's so important for us all to really show up. It's not okay to just complain and talk about it in private anymore. We really need to not just sign those petitions, but make the calls to our senators, to our governors, to our representatives, show up at the rallies. Really, we need to put the pressure on so that we create this movement. And when I'm talking to my guests later, Brett Tolley will talk about how you can help move the fish movement also in the right direction. So don't go anywhere. We'll be talking about that in a little while. And the American Farmland Trust is also working hard to help the school lunch program. There's a there is a bill in Albany that will increase local produce on students' plates. So there's incentives for schools to purchase local produce, and that is a really great thing. Right now, Governor Cuomo has proposed $10 million in the state budget to quadruple the current school meal reimbursement, and that could be a really great thing. And buying more fruits and vegetables from our local farms and getting that on school plates would be really great. So please call your representatives in Albany and encourage them to support that bill. Okay, so I want to share with you my recipe. Last week, as you know, I did seitan marsala, and it's one of my all-time favorites, especially if you're entertaining people who are used to eating meat and they're coming over and you're trying to give them a vegetarian meal. So it's a really great one. But I had some of the seitan I bought. You know, there's different qualities out there, and you really need to experience the different brands that are out there to find a brand that really holds up. White Wave, you know, Whole Foods wasn't carrying it. They didn't have Raise. Those are the ones I usually like. So I bought a new one that I hadn't really used before, and it crumbled a lot. So it didn't work so great for my seitan marsala, but I saved those crumbles, and they were great in this next recipe, which is a spaghetti bolognese, a vegan spaghetti bolognese. And it just, seitan lends itself so well to being like mock chopped meat in a marinara sauce. So it's very simple, and I want to share that with you. And I was in a rush. I realized I did not even put sauteed onions in here. I maybe would add sauteed onions the next time if I was doing this. But 1 cup of chopped seitan, and you're going to saute that in some olive oil, 1.5 tablespoons of tomato paste, 3 tablespoons of white wine, 1 tablespoon of dried oregano, 1 teaspoon of dried basil, 2 tablespoons minced garlic, 1/4 teaspoon red pepper flakes, which is optional, that just gives it a little bit of a spice, 1 can of diced fire-roasted tomatoes, 1 24-ounce jar of organic marinara sauce, 3 tablespoons chopped fresh Italian parsley, and salt and pepper to taste. And so I cooked the pasta according to the directions. You know, you want the pasta to be al dente. Depending on what kind of pasta you use, depends on how you cook it. Whole wheat pasta, you know, you want to cook al dente, but you don't want it to be too hard. Brown rice pasta, you really need to rinse under water after you cook it. You need to cook it all the way, rinse it, and then you can add it to the pan with the sauce to heat it up again. But brown rice pasta needs to, after you cook it, you need to wash off some of the starch. Otherwise, it's really sticky and sticks together. Or, of course, you can use organic semolina pasta. But whatever pasta you use, you want to time it so that you're taking the pasta out once the sauce is made and adding it right into the pan with the sauce. So while you're boiling the water for the pasta, you're going to coat the bottom of a cast iron pan with some olive oil. Saute the seitan for a few minutes and until it starts to sear on the outside. Then add the garlic and cook it until it's golden. Then you're going to add the tomato paste and let the tomato paste cook in the cast iron pan a little bit. That brings out some of the smokiness of the tomato paste flavor. And then you're going to deglaze the pan with the white wine and cook that until the wine is absorbed. Then add the fire-roasted tomatoes, the oregano and the basil, and cook that down again until the juice is absorbed. Then add the jar of tomato sauce and the fresh parsley. Let that simmer for about 10 minutes. And then when the pasta is ready, take the pasta out with just either tongs, or you can actually, you know, you might want to reserve just a little bit of the water in case you want to thin the sauce out a little bit. But you're going to take the pasta and put it right into the pan and toss the pasta and the sauce together. And you can finish it in the pan just a couple minutes and then serve it. And it was delicious. It was really quick, you know, one of those quick meals for in the middle of the week. I had just gotten back from traveling, didn't have a lot of time, and, you know, it whipped up in 15 minutes. So enjoy, and, of course, let me know how you liked it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest today, Brett Tolley. He is the community organizer for the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance. And the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance is a fisherman-led organization that's working to build a movement towards healthy fisheries and fishing communities. And they're working to build relationships with fishermen, the crew that work on the boats, the fish workers, and to create allies to change policy and market strategies. And Brett comes from a four-generation commercial fishing family out of Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and he's been, you know, really leading the way and involved with a lot of nonprofit organizations really working for food justice. One of them is localcatch.org, another one is the Farm to Institution New England, another one Sustainable Business Network, and, of course, Slow Fish, which I'm very involved with. Actually, not Slow Fish, but Slow Food. And Slow Fish is one aspect of the slow food movement. So I'm really thrilled to have him on. Brett, are you with me?
Hi, Bhavani. Pleasure to be here.
Hi. Thank you for joining me. It's been a long time since we spoke, huh?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. Good to hear you. Thanks for having me back.
Sure. So, you know, everybody's heard about community-supported agriculture. And, you know, when I first started with the slow food movement, there was no such thing as community-supported fisheries, and we just started hearing little bits of it, and it's been really wonderful to watch it grow. Can you talk to us about community-supported fisheries and building that movement?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so the community-supported fishery model was basically the fishing community stealing some of the good lessons learned from the family farmers, right? We knew that CSAs were helping family farmers get better price, connect to their community, be incentivized to use ethical practices in their farming. And so we thought, hey, that sounds pretty good. Our family fishermen could really use a boost. And the piloting CSF was in 2007 in a small rural community in Maine called Port Clyde, Maine. So the Port Clyde fishermen were struggling with their price. At the time, they were catching northern shrimp and getting something like 30 cents a pound. And they just realized that with such a low price, and part of that price, they were getting squeezed on what they were getting paid for because they were competing with global industrial scale shrimp that was being imported from all over and really cheap, right? So they got together and said, look, if we continue fishing at 30 cents a pound, the only way we can make a living is to catch high volume. And if we all go for high volume, this stock of shrimp will no longer be sustainable. We have to find another way. And so that was really the spark to do something different. They had heard about a community-supported agriculture, said, hey, let's give that a shot. Let's try and connect our community more directly to this shrimp. Let's try and get a fair price that can allow us to take some pressure off of this shrimp stock. And let's, you know, let's allow our community to help us out. And so that's where it started. And it was a huge success. By the end of that year, fishermen were getting paid $1 a pound for the shrimp. They were able to take some pressure off. local people were getting connected more directly to their source of seafood. And it was awesome. And about a year after that, during that same year, actually, this is interesting, a community in North Carolina also started a community-supported fishery called Walking Fish around the same time. And then on the west coast of Canada, another community-supported fishery popped up called Skipper Otto's. And over the years, it snowballed. At this point, we have over 50 community-supported fisheries around the country on every coast. And then Canada on the east coast, west coast, they're popping up community-supported fisheries in London, Australia, all over. And we've helped organize a hub of all of those CSFs so folks can easily connect with them. And that's under the website localcatch.org. So I'd encourage folks to check that out.
Localcatch.org. Okay. You were saying that the shrimp, they then were selling directly to people for $1 a pound. Did I hear right?
Yeah.
Regular shrimp?
The price. So the northern shrimp, it's a smaller stock and species of shrimp that really migrates around that northern Gulf of Maine area between like the Nova Scotia area off of Canada and then north of New Hampshire, pretty much. It's a pretty small migration. It's a much smaller shrimp than what folks may be used to. It's very sweet. It's a different kind of breed than the Gulf shrimp or other shrimp that you would typically see in the grocery store.
Mm-hmm. I have so many questions for you, but just while we're talking about shrimp, you know, many of us heard that you want to get wild shrimp. You don't want, you know, the shrimp that's dredged from the ocean. But then the wild shrimp that they're selling in Whole Foods has all been from the Gulf of Mexico. What about the oil spill that happened in the Gulf of Mexico? I mean, is it really better to buy that wild shrimp coming from the Gulf of Mexico?
Yeah, it's tricky. Yeah, I mean, it gets to that question of, you know, what are the values that we consider that we might want to encourage people to consider when they buy? Part of it, it's true. Of course, you want to think about your health and health concerns, so that's a factor. But there's a lot of other factors too. For example, like labor. Last year, a story broke in the Associated Press and the New York Times covered it quite a bit with issues of slavery that are prevalent in the global supply chain for shrimp, in particular large-scale shrimp aquaculture. It was riddled with examples of using slave labor to reduce, you know, their costs and just pump out really cheap shrimp all over the place. And so in the United States, 99% of the shrimp we consume is imported, and our ability to trace and track it back to the source is really difficult. So that's a value. And I think we should all consider that as a pretty high level value that we, you know, keep in mind, like labor exploitation involved in the food that we eat matters. Right. But then this other side, you know, if we're thinking about the Gulf of Maine, or Gulf of Mexico, shrimp and all of the pollution issues and the oil. Yeah, that's a factor too. And that's not unique. There are other bodies of water that have also been exploited and polluted, and our fish swim in them, right? So that's something that we need to keep track of. At least for the Gulf of Mexico, I know that the federal kind of Department of Health and all of the various agencies that oversee the health of our food seems like they're on top of it. Like I talk to a lot of fishing community advocates down there in the Gulf, and I think they feel pretty confident that the shrimp coming out of the Gulf will not make people sick. And from the fishing family perspective, I think we all want that, right? Nobody wants to catch something that enters the market that will make anybody sick.
Of course.
But it's questionable sometimes, right? Like you don't know long-term effects and all that. So it's kind of messy, you know? So I would think to some degree, there is an element of maybe toxins or pollutants that are in a lot of our foods. And so I would caution moderation for anybody that basically eats, right? I think that that's a helpful tool. And to stay on top of it. You know, we try and create opportunities for people to put pressure instead of putting a lot of pressure on our fishermen and fishing women to say, you know, let's stop, you know, stop fishing this and stop fishing that. We also want to turn the pressure onto the major polluters and those oil companies that should have responsibility, not just in the Gulf of Mexico, but other places as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so much. You know, I talk about that all the time because they just don't,
right.
You know, they get to pollute and make the profit. And then we're left as a taxpayer cleaning up the mess. And
exactly.
It's completely not right. Yeah, very interesting. You know, like you said, with moderation with all of our food, because all of it has contaminants. We really need to vary what we eat. And do the best we can to try to source the best we can. So
right.
I would come away from what you just said about shrimp with, it's better to buy local wild shrimp from the Gulf
yeah.
and just not eat it all the time. Would you say
exactly.
That's probably the takeaway?
Yeah.
So, you know, so often we also hear about fraud when it comes to the seafood industry. Like you were saying with the shrimp, you know, trying to, you know, trace it back to where it actually came from, you know. Well, even more blatantly, we have, you know, people who don't know fish. You know, you have red snapper that, you know, red snapper, you can kind of see what red snapper looks like. But, you know, different fishes that people are saying, well, yeah, this is wild and it's not really wild, or this is cod when it's really something else, you know. And, you know, how do you trust where you're getting your fish from? How do you trust that they're telling you the truth?
Yeah, so fraud is a really big deal in our food system in general, but even a bigger deal when it comes to seafood. Oceana, the national nonprofit, Oceana did a couple years long research project to investigate instances of fraud in the seafood supply chain. And what they concluded was over 30% of all seafood sold in the U.S. is fraud. Over 30% of what they tell you is one fish is actually a different fish. So it's an enormous number, right?
Yeah.
So what do we do about that? I think for us, you know, it's we really support the community-supported fishery model in part because it connects people directly to their source of seafood. And we recognize not everybody has a CSF near them, but there are many other values-based seafood businesses that can trace back to the boat. So that's for us as a starting point. You know your fishermen, know where your fish came from to the extent that you can. Is one of the really helpful ways to avoid the massive amount of seafood fraud that we have in the country. And there's a couple really great kind of innovative momentum around traceability labels and the use of QR codes that seafood businesses are using. Red's Best, based in Boston, helped pioneer like the first use of these QR codes. And that's a good start. It helps people, you know, be even buyers too. You know, the seafood fraud is not just about at the retail side, but also large buyers in the middle of the supply chain are also dealing with fraud, where they're being told one thing when really it's another. And so the QR codes can really go a long way. A good use of technology, and we're hoping that as technology even advances further, that it will become easier and more affordable for all different companies involved in the seafood supply chain to be using this technology. But traceability is huge. I think that's the way we can combat this fraud.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you the question that you just answered. You know, is it just the retail stores, or are they actually buying something that they think is something else? And so they're kind of like an innocent person in the, you know, in the equation.
Yeah, it's like, absolutely, yeah. It's kind of like this really convenient truth, or this really convenient lie that folks involved in the supply chain just want to hear. If you're a buyer on Long Island and you're going to sell somewhere inland, you want to hear from those at the docks that this was caught just yesterday, that it's local and it was caught by a family fisherman. You want to hear that. And so once they buy that fish and they might sell to another distributor, they tell the same story. when oftentimes it's not really true. And when folks go to the, you know, go up to the seafood market to buy, that's, you know, what we all want to hear, which is great. I think we've done a good job at getting folks to think about those questions. You know, did this come from a family fisherman? Was this, you know, caught, you know, locally? Is this fresh? Those are great questions to be answering, you know, to be asking. And in many ways, it's a sign of success that we've made it kind of valuable, or we've made it a little bit of a popular criteria, you know, for people when they buy seafood. And so that's where the fraud is coming from, right? People want to be able to claim local. They want to be able to claim it came from a family fisherman. And so we just need more accountability. And these QR codes and traceability is a good start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, a lot of people have been touting the benefits of hydroponics. And, you know, I'm sure you're aware of the whole debate that's mm-hmm. gone on with whether hydroponics can be called organic. And, they fast track to organic when they're not really organic. And what are they feeding the plants? And is that food mm-hmm. organic? And, you know, so there's all that question. And that comes up also when we're talking about aquaculture. How does aquaculture right. play into all this? And is it, you know, what are we feeding the fish? I mean, of course, many of us have seen the Dan Barber TEDx talk of, his friend the fish, and, you know, and what are they feeding the fish? And you find out that they're feeding the fish pellets, and what are fish pellets made from? And they're made from chicken parts, and fish aren't supposed
That's
to be eating
right.
chicken. So what, can you talk to us about aquaculture, and what are we feeding the fish in the aquaculture? And, you know, everyone's also heard about tilapias being the most, you know, over aquacultured fish, and that's not really, you know, yeah. chefs don't want to use tilapia at all. So let's talk about that a little.
Sure, yeah. So I believe as of right now, aquaculture is the fastest growing segment of our entire food system. When it comes to seafood on a global level, aquaculture just surpassed wild caught. So as of right now, over 50% of all the seafood that we consume on planet Earth is coming from aquaculture. So it's a big deal. It's growing very fast with enormous amounts of investment into aquaculture. Right? And I'll get to that in a second. But, you know, aquaculture, I think, has been criticized pretty heavily on so many different dynamics. The feed that goes into aquaculture, like you're saying, has been one of the primary critiques of aquaculture. For many years, it was clear that for some of the main, like, aquaculture species, like salmon and tilapia, that the amount of wild protein that was being removed from the ocean in order to grow salmon and tilapia was actually more protein than what it was yielding in the salmon and tilapia, right? So it was kind of a net loss to the ocean. It required more mm-hmm. protein to remove from the ocean than what it was yielding in terms of the fish. So major problem, not sustainable. And that was just, right. that's just scratching the surface. But for us, the biggest issue when it comes to aquaculture is this question of scale, right? Similar to wild caught fish, like scale matters, just like on land and in our land-based food system. The difference between industrial scale and community scale is enormous. So we start with that, making that recognition that industrial scale aquaculture is fundamentally a problem when you have outside investment aiming for the bottom line of maximizing profit at whatever risk to the environment or community. Like, that is just fundamentally wrong. We've seen recent examples, actually, with Cook Aquaculture is one of the largest aquaculture multinational corporations that we have, located in Massachusetts, but they do business all over.
Cook, C-O-O-K, Cook, or K?
C-O-O-K-E.
Ah, okay.
Cook Aquaculture. And if anyone has been following, just a couple weeks ago in the Puget Sound off of Alaska, Cook Aquaculture had an enormous breach in their, like, pet pen, where they grow salmon, and over 200,000 aquaculture, artificially grown salmon escaped into the wild, which is incredibly problematic. they initially tried to cover it up and minimize the reality of what was happening. But when the state of Alaska got involved, they really exposed how significant the problem really was. And so this is an example. You know, we see with this scale of aquaculture, when a mistake happens, it's enormously damaging. And in some cases, irreparably damaging. So we have to start with scale. So, you know, most
Can I just back up, you know, for those...
Yeah, go ahead.
I just want, for those listening, one of the problems, you know, of the salmon escaping, from what I've heard, and you probably, of course, you know much more than me, but, you know, is that those fish then go and try to mate with the wild salmon, right? And they are not, they can't mate, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the mating, well, that in some cases they do mate successfully, but it completely shifts the genetic makeup of wild caught in some cases forever, right? There's that just moral question about integrating a genetically engineered animal with a wild animal.
Yeah, I thought they were infertile, though. They're not infertile?
No. No, And I mean, and there's so many, honestly, I'm sure there are species of aquaculture fish that they grow to be infertile, but it's not across the board. And then the other aspect with escape from, you know, aquaculture pens is that inside the pens, oftentimes the artificially grown fish are developing resistance to diseases, and they kind of carry certain diseases with them while they grow. And when they escape, they can introduce all of these new diseases to the wild species that all of a sudden can die off very quickly. And I think that's probably the biggest threat that they're seeing right now out in the Puget Sound with this escaped salmon.
Now, are farm-raised, you know, aquaculture is the same as when you hear farm-raised, correct?
Yes.
When you hear about farm-raised fish, that's aquaculture we're talking about, right? What is in the feed? Are they, when they're doing farm-raised fish, they're also giving them like antibiotics like we do with the chickens, correct?
Yep. Antibiotics, different chemicals to help them grow faster, chemicals to help influence their color, all sorts of things.
Right, artificial coloring, because otherwise they're not pink, because they're not...
Exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and in the same way that we have issues surrounding CAFOs on land, I always forget the acronym, contained animal feed or something, you know, they have these high condensed areas
for
pigs and cows. CAFOs, condensed, that we see the same problems with fish farm pens. It's a really condensed area. And there's animal rights issues, I think, there too, that we often don't talk about when it comes to aquaculture. These are still animals that I think should be treated with a certain level of decency. But I also want to say there are some fish farms that are doing it great too and are operating at a community scale that is in line with what the ecosystem can handle, just above, you know, off in your neck of the woods, Bhavani, off of Long Island. There's a really fantastic small-scale operation led by Bren Smith, who calls himself an ocean farmer to try and distinguish himself from the more industrial aquaculture that is more prevalent. But Bren, you know, he uses species that are indigenous to the area. He works mostly with shellfish and kelp. And he has this really great kind of what he calls a 3D integrated aquaculture, where he grows the species of shellfish and kelp together so that they reinforce each other. It's a really cool operation. And also, when it comes to shellfish can actually absorb some of the toxins in the water and produce oxygen and help actually clean some of our waterways. So when it comes to shellfish aquaculture, it's also just a different story entirely, especially when it comes to the ecological impacts.
Yeah, well, they have, you know, they're doing the oyster farms all by LaGuardia Airport, right, to clean up all the water.
That's right.
there, but those are not, they're not then going to sell those oysters, right? That's really, they're really doing it as a remediation for the water, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Wow. So many questions. So are there regulations? You know, what kind of regulations are there? And how can listeners get involved in creating better policies so that, you know, these things don't happen? So that, you know what are the fish being fed? You know, you know, transparency in the whole market.
Yeah. Well, so for what are the regulations? I mean, there are so many regulations similar to other aspects of our food system that govern our seafood and oversee it. We have, from the town to the state to the federal to regional. And when it comes to aquaculture, I think they deal with each one of those levels of oversight and policy that determines how they do it, where they do it, when they do it. I think one aspect that's kind of interesting for us at the moment is the use of kind of ocean area to do aquaculture business. I think it's interesting because, you know, historically and as of right now, our ocean is a public commons resource that we all have a stake in it. We all own it collectively, like the Grand Canyon. But what we're seeing right now is that small chunks of the ocean are really on the brink of becoming more like a private property that one business can control. They can sell it off and essentially exclude the public for any from any kind of oversight or management. So that's a huge red flag for us. But the largest governing kind of policy body that oversees all of fisheries, not just aquaculture, but also the wild catch, is called the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act. It's a mouthful. We call it the Fish Bill. Very similar to the Farm Bill. The Fish Bill governs everything having to do with fish. And it's currently being reauthorized in Congress right now. We are organizing our network to influence it in a couple top priority areas, and we got our work cut out for us with this new administration.
I'm sure you do. I want to talk more about that, but let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I would like to hear more about the Fish Bill and what my listeners can do, because as you know, I'm really trying to get everyone to become activists. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Brett Tolley from the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, and we'll be right back.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Yeah, I'm not known as a gadget guy, but I love gadgets that really do the trick, like the new app. The Progressive Radio Network has an app, thanks to our friends at Audio Now. Hey, this is Mark Farrell, host of Insight on Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we broadcast live out of New York City. But if you can't catch the show live, no frets. It's always archived. It's always on the app. Download it now, listen later, whenever you want. The Progressive Radio Network app is available from our friends at Audio Now. Check it out.
It's not liberal, it's not conservative, it's progressive, the truth that empowers, right here on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Why would anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course? Well, this is me, and I've got some riveting experiences to share with you. Hey, I'm Mark Farrell. Join me for Insight, a new show coming to PRN.FM. It's about overcoming adversity, and who doesn't experience this in some capacity? I'm no doctor, but I'm an expert in me since I've been dealing with various forms of adverse conditions all my life, like having a rare visual disability that challenges much of what I do. insight, real-life issues, including mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Celebrity guests will also reveal on Insight how they overcame adversity to make it, as well as your calls on challenges you struggle with. My difference makes me stronger. That's my mantra. Listen and discover how your difference makes you stronger. Insight, Thursdays at 11 a.m. only on PRN.FM.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest is Brett Tolley from NAMA, the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance. And we're talking about the fish bill. So, Brett, so many questions about this fish bill, like the farm bill. You know, so much of the reality comes down to policy, you know, in enforcing those policies. What are we looking for the fish bill to do this time around?
Yeah, so for us, the top priority is to address this policy vehicle that's called catch shares. That is privatizing our fisheries access, consolidating the fleet, and leading to the corporate takeover of the ocean. That's what catch shares are designed to do. They've been modeled around the world. In the United States, they've been gaining more and more traction over the past 20, 25 years. In the last fish bill reauthorization, they gained enormous ground in terms of prioritizing catch share policy. It became a national priority in terms of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric branch of the government. And made it a national priority to implement these policies around the country. So that's, for us, that's kind of number one. This is an enormous problem. We need to address it. We need to create alternatives, and we need to stop it in its tracks. So we'll be organizing around that for the upcoming year. And we've been organizing around those issues for the past 7 years.
Mm-hmm. So does a fish bill also get into regulation of what you're feeding the fish? And what about also the, not just genetically modified fish, but the actual cloning of fish? You know, is that being addressed in the fish bill as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, to be honest, I mean, because, you know, our work and our movement work, we primarily focus on wild caught in ocean animals, and you know, fishermen and women who fish out in the wild ocean. So when it comes to the detailed policy, it's not really, or when it comes to aquaculture policy, it's not completely in our wheelhouse. And that won't be what we'll be focusing on for this fish bill in terms of our work. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think when it comes to the broadest policy that governs aquaculture, a lot of that actually falls under the USDA and a couple other branches of government, whereas the oversight and policy that governs all of our wild catch in the United States falls under the Department of Commerce and then NOAA under that.
What's NOAA stand for?
Yeah, so the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association.
Uh-huh.
NOAA, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, we were talking, you told me about the Netflix documentary that you were very involved in called Cod is Dead. Can you tell us a little bit about that and... you know, and that goes really gets into the corporate takeover of the oceans, does it not?
Yeah, right on. Yeah. So for folks, if you have access to Netflix, they just came out with a new series called Rotten that highlights a variety of interesting aspects of our food system. And one of the episodes is called Cod is Dead. And that highlights the policy I was just talking about, catch share policy, that's been implemented around the United States that's leading toward this corporate takeover of the ocean. And one of the examples the Cod is Dead highlights is this story of the Codfather. The Codfather, also Carlos Rafael, based in New Bedford, Massachusetts, is one of the largest fleet owners in the entire United States. A lot of our campaign work was to highlight why the concentration of fisheries access into the hands of a few, like the Codfather, was problematic, similar to how we've seen consolidation in other aspects of our agriculture system, our banking system. The Codfather was basically like the Rupert Murdoch of the fisheries. When we were doing our campaign work at the same time, the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, did an undercover investigation into claims of fraud and cheating of the system on behalf of the Codfather. They hired actors to pretend to be Russian fish buyers who wanted to buy out the Codfather's company. The Codfather then disclosed how he's been cooking the books, cheating the system, calling one fish one thing when it's really another, and smuggling millions of dollars outside of the country by paying off a TSA agent at the airport. It's crazy. It was like something written for the movies. And so he got charged. He ultimately pled guilty to 27 accounts. A federal judge sentenced him to 4 years in prison, 3 years probation, and then that was part of the criminal side of the case. And then NOAA also is bringing a civil charge, which will ban the Codfather forever from all fisheries in the United States and revoke 32 of his permits, which are worth millions of dollars, and essentially reallocate them into the fleet. So that's where we're at. It's a really interesting moment. But for us, it's this huge example of this is what these policies are designed to give us as the public. They concentrate access into a few powerful hands, and we know it's wrong. It's wrong for our communities. It leads to displacement of our families, small-scale fishermen. It's bad for our food system. It leads to massive imports, exports, and it's ultimately bad for our ocean. The Codfather's fleet put enormous fishing pressure in areas of our ecosystem that just couldn't withstand, led to some major stocks declining. And so we need to learn. So this, for us, is this huge moment to learn this lesson, get it right, move away from the policies that are privatizing access, move more towards community. And this documentary is one of the best ones I've ever seen on the issues.
Mm. Good. Good. And just before we run out of time, I just want to touch on the slow fish movement, because I know you've been very involved in that, and slow food is so close to my heart, running the local chapter here on Long Island. So can you tell us about slow fish a little bit? I know recently you were at the United Nations speaking on behalf of slow food.
So I'm excited. So slow fish on an international level began probably in the late 2000s, 2007 or 8, kind of a no-brainer, right? I think as slow food as a movement was growing, there's been all these, you know, branches of slow cheese and slow money and slow wine, everything.
Slow meat.
And so, slow meat. So it's about time we had a slow fish. It started with some international gatherings in Italy, and I was a part of that toward the beginning. And then it wasn't really until 2013 that we made a concerted effort to bring a slow fish campaign to the United States, and began building slowly. And then we had our first gathering in 2015 in New Orleans. It was awesome. We had hundreds of people from around the country come down to New Orleans to talk about slow fish and talk about what good, clean, and fair seafood looks like. Those are the basic tenets of the slow food movement, good, clean, and fair, right? So it's a kind of a budding network. I think it's exciting. We have our second national gathering coming up April 14th to the 16th in San Francisco, and the San Francisco Slow Food chapter has been enormously gracious and in helping to organize and be like the host community to organize the slow fish gathering. So, it's open to the public. For that particular gathering, there's a website. It's sfslowfish.com, like San Francisco slowfish.com. So check it out, sfslowfish.com. That's one way to get involved. Maybe I want to share other ways to get involved, but I'll pause there.
Coming up in the New York area that I should tell people about?
Yeah, for sure. So another way that we try to connect folks to the movement building and to become activists, like you said, Bhavani, or join what we call the revolution on the ocean, the revolution. The ways to get involved, we have these events called Seafood Throwdowns. We have a couple coming up this summer in the New York City area. One will be in Brooklyn at Grand Army Plaza. Should be happening around mid-July. And Seafood Throwdown, it's a fun cooking competition. We get two local chefs that go head-to-head. We highlight a locally caught seafood that people may not be familiar with, but is being caught locally. We tell the story behind the fish. We bring out the fisher that caught it. We have a fun conversation. It's engaging. And at the end, we get to try the fish.
And I'll definitely share that with everybody when it's happening. I do every year because it is a wonderful event.
And then
so we're just about out of time, Brett.
Okay.
So I want to thank you so much. The work you're doing is unbelievable. And this is a nonprofit organization, is it not? NAMA?
Yeah. The Northwest Atlantic
Marine Alliance. So people can make donations to NAMA.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we welcome all donations. NAMANet.org is our website. Join our Facebook, join our newsletter. We'd love to have you be part of the work we're doing.
Great. Well, we need everyone to be part of the work you're doing because you're really doing some really important work. So thank you on behalf of all of us. Everyone out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.